Sounds like you on this end.
Hey, hey.
We may have got Snoopy here. Is that having any adverse effects of putting him on the table?
Oh, no, my goodness. No, I think, well, I guess good for pictures. Fourth crew.
He looks like he had a bad night.
Okay, we're about ready to get started. First, a couple of announcements. One, we request that the camera crews pack up and depart the main auditorium as soon as possible after this briefing. The Voice of America and the European Pool will utilize a facility for their private interview. Second, we will adhere to our standing ground rule that only those that do not have individual interviews will be granted the privilege of asking questions at this session. At this point, let me introduce the crew. I think you all know them. From my left, Tom Stafford, John Young, Gene Cernan. You want to take over at this point, Tom?
Well, to bring all the media up to date on what has transpired, we think that everything is pretty well squared away for the flight. It is certainly a challenging flight and the most difficult one today in terms of everything going together in it. There's been a tremendous workload on all three of us, but I think we're well ahead of the game and ready to go. The liftoff should occur a little after 12 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on the 18th, and we'll have our translunar injection occur approximately 2 hours and 20 minutes later. At this time, I'm flying the left seat, John's the center, Gene's in the right. After translunar injection, I swap seats with John, who does the transposition and docking phase. And we worked it out so that the command module pilot always does the transposition and docking. And this is also the first time, I think, that you'll ever see recorded in, say, live color, the transposition and docking of two space vehicles. We're planning this if everything works right. So I'd like to have John go into this part of it.
Well, transposition and docking, which is done on Mission D, involves separating the spacecraft from the Saturn, pitching around 180 degrees, rolling 60 degrees, and going in and docking. And then we go into the tunnel of the two vehicles. The lunar module has launched with a pressure relief valve open, so it's depressurized. We repressurize the lunar module, go into the tunnel, remove the hatch, verify the docking latches, hook some power up to it so we can remove it from the Saturn and separate. And from then on, we're on our way. Right after we separate, we have an evasive maneuver plan to get away from the Saturn, which is then slingshot around the moon. A little while later, we have a mid-course, pretty large mid-course, about 50, 60 feet a second, nominally, to get us on a plane change at the moon, which will be an identical orbit to what the G mission plans to fly. And after that, we go into what we call the passive thermal control mode operation, which is set up so that the spacecraft is essentially inertially stabilized toward the northern stars. It's looking at the northern stars. The revolution is one revolution per hour, so that out the side hatch windows, the hatch window and the two side windows, every rev you get to see the Earth and the moon. I think that's going to be very fascinating.
Why don't we have Gene tell us a little bit about the translunar coast and what we expect to do in it at this time?
Well, the translunar coast is sort of like 2.5 days of sheer ecstasy waiting for that 24 hours of stark terror that we're going to be confronted with. But it really probably, the translunar coast coming and going is probably the most least active part of the whole mission. It consists primarily of mid-course maneuvers. We really begin to get active preparing for LOI or lunar orbit insertion, at which time we then, right after LOI, really go into the lunar module at, before our first sleep period around the moon and see really what shape the LEM came through the boost phase with and what shape it came through the 3 days of COAST. And of course this is very, very critical, because critical in that the LEM has never really been in a lunar environment. We've never really made it passive and just taken along for a ride for any great length of time. On Apollo 9, of course, it survived the boost phase in very fine shape. We expect it will survive the 3 days of lunar COAST in equally good shape, but you just want to go in there that first time and make sure that that everything is pretty well status quo, a very minor systems checkout, and primarily what we call some housekeeping chores, setting up cameras and setting up our floodlights. And this is our translunar COAST into our LOI period prior to our big rendezvous and descent day.
Well, the two real busy days of the mission involves the second and the third day around the moon as such. And again, one of the basic reasons for flying this mission is to pull together all the knowledge we've had in the previous ones. And our mascot over here. We have determined from the previous mission, lunar orbit mission, and also from the lunar module mission, that there's a lot of questions that still aren't answered, and particularly concerning the lunar potential. And where our new flight computer ropes are being put in at the Cape this weekend for the lunar module and the command module. They'll be tested out within the next week. This has a new lunar potential that is, and also it's the same as the one that Mission Control has changed to. And with this, we hope that we can be able to predict our orbits the way that the lunar gravitational field affects us in a far better fashion than we have before. Because the way that the present setup is, there is a possibility of aborting the first landing mission unless we actually bring back the data and show what we have for altitude tracking on the lunar surface. And we're going to do this in several different ways. But the big day is really the second day there, and we're going to be separated from the command module for 8 hours and 20 minutes and go down to 50,000 feet on two passes. In fact, we were just thinking, coming back from the Cape last night, we're flying a T-38 at about 45,000 feet, and we could look down and we're picking out points that were 25 and 30 feet in diameter. Occasionally you could see a truck on the road. So we think from 50,000 feet we will be able to see craters that could get the lunar module in trouble. Along with that, we just realized it's the first time that man has ever been this fast, this low. It's equivalent to Mach number. It's about Mach 9 at 8.5 miles. So we're going to be moving out across the surface. But the real, as busy as we're going to be, the real busy man is going to be John in the command module, because he's going to be up there going through his complete routine at this time. John, why don't you tell us about
that? While they're doing the rendezvous, the basic thing the command module does is sort of try to act like MCC Moon. We're up there tracking them and following them around the countryside, and the system is doing its own navigation. It's doing its own orbit prediction, and it's doing its own determination of what kind of maneuvers you have to make to get rejoined. But it doesn't do it by itself. So there's a lot of button pushing and a lot of control switch operations, and it's really a scramble. And if everything goes normally, why, we won't do anything except pass a few maneuver pads back and forth. But if for some reason, and it has to be pretty way down on the scale of probabilities because of all the systems and all the redundant systems in the lunar module, we were to have to use the command module to go get the LEM, what we call lunar module rescue, then we could do it with a command module.
Gene, why don't you amplify some about our descent and when we start to make the critical maneuver back behind the moon and how we go back around on the front side and what we'll see.
You know, in amplifying what John said, all the time that we're in the lunar module, prior to undocking, which is some 4 hours or three and a half to four and a half hours prior to undocking, and all the time we're actually in the rendezvous, in the descent, and then eventually after the insertion burn in the rendezvous phase, all of our attitudes, all of our mission profile is tied directly to John and to what John is doing. And I've never really been involved, I don't believe, in anything that is required as great amount of coordination and teamwork as it is trying to work with two vehicles in a lunar environment when they're traveling at the speeds and you're talking about calculating burns with the decenter ascent engines or with the service propulsion engine in case of a rescue maneuver down to the seconds. This is where our simulator time has come in so valuable. We've worked what we call integrated with mission control here in Houston, with John in the command module, and with us in the, Tom and I in the lunar module. And when we first did it, the first time we did it, it was unbelievable. You just have to understand what the other fellow's doing and what his problems really are. Now today, we feel, as of yesterday, for instance, that we are working together very closely as a team, and I think this is the key to this whole mission, especially when you separate two vehicles. When we actually separate, then we'll do our descent orbit insertion burn, which will then take us down out of a 60 nautical mile orbit with John down to, it looks like about 8.8 miles is what we've been seeing in a simulator most of the time, and that's the time at which we'll make that high-speed pass across the lunar surface. And up until this time, we're simulating in real time, in real life, the G mission, the lunar landing mission. It's not until we come down across the site at 10 miles where we do what we call a phasing maneuver of almost 200 feet per second that we now go into away from the G type of mission. That's a point at which they will literally begin their slow down and descent, and that's a point at which we now go and set ourselves up for what we call an insertion burn and a rendezvous, which again then will simulate the G mission, find out what problems that might be resolved or might evolve from our mission concerning their rendezvous, and then eventually into the what we call the normal co-elliptic rendezvous phase. I don't know if you really want to go into the details about the DOI burn, but I did want to stress one point, and that is this, the teamwork factor, and I think we were all amazed that it took so much coordination, and not only between the three of us, Houston plays a very close-knit part in all of this coordination.
You know, people often ask us, what happens if anything goes wrong? Well, all three of us decided to submit a request to George Lowe for a 350-mile steel wire, but he has yet to see fit to acknowledge your request. But this is a test out to the max range of the radar. We'll be going a little over 350 miles, which should really test the past the normal case in the lunar mission for the airborne parts. Well, actually, after the limb is on the ground, you will have distances far greater than that. But this should prove out the total system.
I'd like to just add one quick thing. And there is obviously a nominal profile, which we're very familiar with and which we've trained with. But the problem is, for every large engine burn in that nominal profile, we have a what we call an abort situation, an abort case, where you may get a partial burn or you may get no burn at all. Now this takes John's procedures and our procedures and in real time completely revamps them. So what you really have to have is another flight plan, rendezvous type of thing to cover every one of those possible abort situations that we think we can get into. This goes for John's procedures and ours. And so as a result, there were at one time 27 different rendezvous that we supposedly would have to be prepared to do on this mission. We've combined them, we've eliminated some cases, we've proved some to be just false emotions and they can't possibly occur, and we've got it now down to where, besides the nominal rendezvous, we actually are training and have procedures for five contingency type of rendezvous maneuvers which we might have to make in case of a bad or a faulty engine or some other systems failure in either one of the spacecraft. And so when John said he's hopping up there. You can see why, because he's spring-loaded. After every time we start our big engine, any one of our big engines, he's spring-loaded to burn his engine in sort of an abort situation in case we don't get a burn at all or a complete burn. So you can almost hear the relief in the sigh in his voice when we say burn complete, and the residuals, the Delavie residuals are nominal, and he just takes a deep breath and gets ready for the next one.
At the end of the rendezvous, we'll come up to station keeping and pitch over. At that time, John will do the docking from the command module. We've ascertained that it's probably simpler and he's better equipped to do it with respect to the handling qualities of the vehicle. After we finish the docking, we have an unmanned burn to depletion on the ascent stage of the limb. John will actually hold the attitude with the command module, and Gene and I will configure the limb, and we come around from the front side of the moon. We'll separate from the lunar module ascent stage. It'll then on a ground command fire up and go on a maneuver that will take it into elliptical orbit around the sun forever. And again, this has got good station coverage from the Earth with respect to the large dish, and so we hope that you can see this limb ascent stage take off around the sun on TV if everything goes right. Well, after this, we hope we get a good 9 hours sleep because it's been a long day. And then the next day starts, and that's when John really gets busy again, because really, to really ascertain where that lunar surface is and what we know today, that most of the weight's on John's shoulders on that landmark tracking. So we want to have him tell you what we're going to do on the all the landmark tracking and the photo passes that we're going to do on the second day.
Well, actually, it's not all on my shoulders, thank goodness. What we're going to do the second day is essentially some strip mapping, some strip photography, I mean, some four revolutions of landmark tracking, and some target of opportunity photography interspersed in those revolutions. Gene will handle the cameras, and Tom will be flying the spacecraft in what we call orb rate. He'll be maintaining a local horizontal with respect to the lunar surface. We have four landmarks on each revolution picked out, and the purpose of doing those doing that landmark tracking is to help us come up. We're flying the same profile as the G mission, is to help us come up with an empirical method of orbit prediction, which will enable them to very accurately target the G mission for the descent and landing, which is very essential in order that the limb land where you want it to. And after we finish that, and of course every revolution around the moon is 2 hours, so it's going to be 8 hours of landmark tracking with a rev and a half of rest period, a couple of revs of strip photography, and a oblique vertical photography where we're taking pictures into the landing site to help us prepare the crews that are trained to go to these landing sites, and also to obtain interesting pictures, pictures that are of interest to the geologists and people who've studied the moon for a long time. Of course, they've given us a whole ream of things that they're interested in taking pictures of. There isn't enough film in the whole world to get all the pictures they'd like to get, but we're going to do our best.
The final maneuver for trans-earth injection comes at approximately 61 hours after we first entered lunar orbit. So we'll be there approximately three times as long as the previous lunar orbit mission. And it'll be about the same exact time as the lunar landing missions. At this time, we'll make if we have the fuel budget, we'll make the trans-earth injection, which is a fast return home, and we'll be coming home in about 53 hours. And Gene, why don't you take it again from the time we start away from the moon?
Well, when we leave the moon, it's going to, of course, it's going to be a good feeling. We're anxious to get there, and of course, I think after that, that trans-Earth insertion burn is going to be a good feeling to sit back and watch the moon get smaller and the Earth get bigger. One of the things we certainly expect and hope to get is, as we do leave the moon, is some more photography, possibly some real-time television to watch that moon just shrink in size, because like the Earth, when we go away very rapidly, and it disappeared, not disappears, but it gets very small very rapidly. And this, we're all anticipating to be one of the most spectacular sights on the trip. On our way back, we do some of our own navigation. Lost comm is always a concern of everybody. There's backup systems to backup systems. And the comm has been excellent, and the S-band communications at lunar distance has been excellent. But we maintain the onboard capability to compute our own mid-course maneuvers in order to hit that entry corridor, hopefully as well as mission control could target us. So we're taking star and horizon sightings. I say we, John primarily is doing this again as eyeballs here, as a navigator. He barely lets Tom and I get near the sextant. He says we got our own NLM and we can't even do a star alignment every once in a while, but he may get a little bit tired and give us a chance on the way home. But we do a lot of sightings again on the way back in particular patterns in order that we can compute our own mid-course, because our one objective on the way home, of course, is to hit that entry corridor properly so that we can land at the targeted spot. And so that primarily is the lunar coast home. Wanna?
A couple of aspects we wanted to bring up before, I guess, we open it for questions. There's been a lot of effort going to the total Project Apollo by a lot of people down at all different levels. And a lot of the success we've had is a lot dependent upon the work and effort and that they have put forth on all the project. And so, as you know, we have a manned flight awareness program that honors the people who have done outstanding work and showed continual work. And believe me, we certainly appreciate it since we're flying the hardware. And one of the symbols of the manned flight awareness program is a little dog I'm sure you're all familiar with, in a cartoon named Snoopy. So when it came to choose the code words for the lunar orbit operation, the two vehicles are separated, we got together, and so the lunar module will be called Snoopy, and the command module is Charlie Brown. So the whole crew should arrive up there, Snoopy and Charlie Brown, after about 76 hours, and the big day takes place there when they're separated for 8 hours and 10 minutes. And I think it should work out very well with respect to the call signs, particularly if somebody says, "Good grief, Charlie Brown."
Yeah, Tom. If I could just say one word. I know there's a lot of people who are probably interested in a television, particularly the aspect of colored television on our flight. Well, if all goes well after our countdown demonstration test, we hope to be able to carry a colored camera aboard, a colored camera which hopefully will give you a feeling, not a vicarious feeling, but an actual visual interpretation of what we're seeing when we're up there. You know, fortunately, or let me put it this way, we've been fortunate enough, the three of us, to have flown before, and we know sincerely how just spectacular and beautiful it is up there. That's not why we're going, of course, but it's one of the things that we see and we get to appreciate. We know this flight's going to even be more spectacular because of the distances and the fact that we're going to a satellite a quarter million miles away. And our feeling about this television, particularly the color television, particularly because I could sit here and try and tell you what the colors look like on a sunrise and sunset, and you could attempt to picture them in your mind, but until you've seen them, until you've been able to feel those colors with your own eyes, you really haven't, you can't transmit it to a person. So through this color television, we hope to be able to do something that I think all of us in this program have wanted to do for a long time, and that's share with you some of the experiences and the things that are happening right now, some of the feelings, the things that go behind the gee whizzes and golly, isn't that beautiful type of thing. So with any luck at all, we'll be able to share, yeah, the aw shuckses too. We'll be able to share, and I use that word very, very sincerely and very strongly from the three of us. We would like to be able to share with you as much of this experience as we possibly can. And I say that sort of because a lot of people have been interested in this color television.
I know that of all the questions I've ever been asked by anybody, in fact, a lot of the people I know out here in the audience, usually the first question is, what was it like up there? Well, I think this is one reason why our crew has pushed to get this device on board so we can show you what it's like. I mean, show the whole American public, and if everything works right, we'll be sending back many hours of it just in real time, and we have it on a non-interference basis with the crew activity, so we're hoping it'll work out good.
Okay, before we go to questions, Tom, I think we should backtrack a minute. We've got this film, the 7-minute film, is typical of the Apollo 10 crew training. Why don't we ring up the film now?
Well, let's see, this shows the three of us out at North American at Downey, California, back when we were working on the 101 spacecraft, and those were the old pressure suits. John, why don't you describe some of the activities on that day?
Okay, what we were going through in this particular instance was C squared F squared for spacecraft 101, which then was the prime crew was Jim McDivitt, Rusty, and Dave. Jim McDivitt, Rusty Swarkert, and we were the backup crew. And if you notice that vehicle, that's the old hatch on spacecraft 101. In fact, that's the ablative cover. And in that particular instance was, I remember it well, was the day of the fire.
You'll notice there's about three evolutions of suits, this one being somewhat of the original suit that we started with in Apollo. And that headgear you saw John with eventually evolved into what we call, and really long before we adopted our names of Snoopy, but we've called that that new helmet we wear, which you'll see here later, the Snoopy helmet. And that sort of was quite just coined by accident, but that name has stuck with the headgear. The name that we gave to the headgear you just saw, I'd rather not repeat at the moment because it wouldn't be too appropriate.
Here you see us about a year later with the new suits. Here's getting in, and it has a beta cloth covering on it. Now, this was a spacecraft 101 configuration that was eventually Apollo 7. We were the backup crew on that.
You can see the suits here are grossly more bulky, as you'll see here a little bit later, compared to the present-day suits we're wearing. This is a mock-up out at North American, of which we did a great deal of work in stowage configuration, couch configuration. Eventually, our new couches evolved out of this type of work and this type of training. You can see there's not a great deal of room in there with three men side by side with the size of the suits the way they were.
John, why don't you narrate this? We're down at pad 39B looking at our booster this day.
Yeah, mainly we're looking up at it. Boy, that's 440 feet up to the top of that thing. It's really something. Right here, we're looking at the gondola that you may have to use for egress. This is the tunnel that you go down to the what we call a rubber room. If you have to do a pad egress, you slide down this thing about 150 foot Teflon coated tunnel with wire spraying on you, and you'll be down at the bottom of it a great deal faster than Gino was.
We're down about, I think, well over 20 feet below the surface, down below the pad in a pad area, and going into this rubber room, as John called it, which is totally sealed hermetically. We've got our own capability of producing our own oxygen in there. Totally closed-loop facilities, and the whole thing to prevent, in case of shock and shock waves, sits on springs. Right. Isn't it big coil springs?
The whole room is on coil springs, and you sit on these special foam padded chairs that can withstand the shock of a direct blast of the Saturn exploding there and withstand the shock. There's enough oxygen, water, food supplies in there for over 24 hours. And it's really a funny feeling to walk around and have the whole room shake with you there. This is a picture of the command module simulator. You see, it's quite an elaborate device with all around it. In fact, John named this the Great Train Wreck with all the shapes there. We spent a lot of time in this vehicle together, all three of us.
Back when we first started, we said if it doesn't work, paint it brown. And we really had our problems getting this baby going, but now we've got good reliability and we've got really smart crews helping us do this training. Look at him heading for gimbal lock there. That's at red. That's a translation controller. Shows he pulls back to go back. To the right, he's going to the right. To the left, down. These are some of the instructors that teach us what we're supposed to do in here.
You know, one of the most common questions I've ever been asked is, well, what do you guys do? People think we do chin-ups for 9 months or a year between our flights and then put on a spacesuit and fly. And it's very difficult to explain to people actually what your training is built around, because there's meetings and decisions and designs, and you build it up. You're sort of an engineer one day, a management meeting the next day, a scientist the next day, and a technician the next day, and the next day you're flying the machine. Well, the meat of our training is right here. In these simulators, there's where you really learn how to fly a spacecraft, and there's where you see where the problems really are, and that's what makes you feel quite at home when you get up in orbit, is our simulators, and they're just fantastic machines with fantastic people operating them.
Here's the command module. I've seen in that simulator coming in the dock at a fairly high rate, and then you can stop, but the degree of fidelity in the simulators is utterly fantastic. Here was one of the tasks we go through to check out the vehicle, and this is an altitude chamber run on our lunar module. We did this in January.
That is Snoopy right there, and we've become quite fond of a Snoopy, and are looking forward to quite a trip with him. This is the altitude chamber, as Tom said, and when you look at the exterior configuration of the lunar module of Snoopy, you really wonder whether it's a spacecraft, because it almost looks like Reynolds wrap in cellophane tape in spots, because that's what it really is. And as compared to the command module, it doesn't have to be the aerodynamic, heat-resistant vehicle designed for Earth re-entry.
John Miles.
This is a docking simulator. This is a docking simulator, and this shows the appearance that the vehicles have when they come together, and speed it up a little faster than normal. Both the lunar module, of course, weighs 32,000 pounds loaded, and a command module 60,000 pounds or a little better loaded. This is a shot through the overhead winner of the lunar module and shows exactly what the lunar module pilot sees looking out at the command module. He doesn't see very much, as you can see, because his window is not very big. He has to translate his control axis 90 degrees, and Tom has done that perfectly on many occasions, and I can tell you from personal experience that to do that is something else.
It's a little different when you're standing up looking overhead and relating your axis to what you're seeing straight ahead, but you get used to it. Here you see the probe coming into the drogue, and in the actual case here it'll be John for this doing this final maneuver. And you see the way that the probe does start to give and come in. This is, again, as far as we take the simulation.
Now, all that gear you see right there, the drogue, the bushel basket end, and the probe, all have to come apart. We have to disassemble that, take it out of the tunnel area, and then that's the area where we crawl through. So the tunnel area is not a clear area as soon as we dock, obviously. You've got the drogue and the probe in there. And if, perchance, of course, we can't get it out, or the drogue and probe do not pull us up tight to make that airtight seal in there, then of course we're prepared, and we have trained. As a matter of fact, we spent about 4 hours on it this morning again in a final training exercise to go EVA if we have to, transferring from the hatch of one vehicle to the hatch of the other vehicle.
Okay, we're available now for questions. Yes, sir.
I have a question for Commander Young. You've described your activities in lunar orbit as being a bit of a scramble. With that in mind, if the situation should occur that you have to go down and pick up the lunar module when it's at its lowest point at 8.8 miles above the lunar surface, where would you be in relation to the module at that time? What would be involved in going down to get it, and how long would the complete rescue maneuver take?
Well, it would probably be a... We did one just the other day, as a matter of fact. We ended up in a 200 by 9 mile orbit. The after DOI, the lunar module is in a 60 by 9 about. So that's what orbit you'd end up in. And it would probably be a five-impulse orbit with a couple of rescue burns, and it might take as long as 7 hours and 30 minutes, 1 hour longer than the regular one. But actually, when you're doing the maneuvers without having to relay all the commands and stop and pick up your pencil and write, when you're doing everything yourself, it's actually simpler than when you have to do the coordination and get all the backup data.
In fact, retrofire to get yourself down to 10 miles.
That's right.
Lock on at 10 miles.
Well, no, sir. It would be a rescue maneuver. It probably puts you in something like a 20-mile circular to give you a catch-up rate, maybe a 20 by 13 or something, to establish a catch-up rate, and then you do another maneuver after that to circularize at that low altitude, and then a couple more, you'd go through a regular nominal maneuver sequence. And you could calculate after the initial couple of canned rescue pads, we calculate the rest of them on board.
I have two questions. If you do have to go EVA, have you selected a name for your portable life support system? And another question for the three of you, do any of you have any plans for leaving the astronaut program after this mission?
Well, I can answer the last question right now. The answer is no. This makes the third flight for both John and myself and second for Gina. I know all three of us want at least one more. As far as the first question, on the portable life support system?
If you do have to go EVA,
right.
Do you have a name selected that you would use in like Snoopy and Charlie Brown for your third communications?
I think they're referring to Red Rover.
Name for the portable life support
system? You mean a name for the portable life support system?
Might have a name for it if it didn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not phrasing my question very well. In the last mission, they had three names.
Red Rover. Red Rover is what she has referenced to.
Oh, no. We
don't. It's Tom and Gene when they're out there on the portable life support system.
Now, we've practiced many runs through this. In fact, we had about a two-hour exercise this morning going through the whole sequence in a mock-up and going over and going in with John, all hard-suited. So we've been through that many times.
You've got to differentiate between a planned EVA and a contingency EVA. A contingency EVA is one that you have to do. I think that says a lot, and I won't say any more about it.
Yes, sir. If you do have to perform one of these rescue maneuvers, won't that drain your fuel supply pretty low? Or are you carrying enough for that?
We're fat as a 40-pound mouse on a fuel.
We're in good shape. We may have to take the slow return home depending on how much SPS we use. But we're all right.
Okay, Russell.
Is there any concern about the so-called Stafford jinx of launch?
Well, it doesn't have anything to do with Tom Stafford. Shoot.
When I flew with Wally on my first flight in Gemini 6, I was sure it was Wally that was the jinx. It cost us three times on the final count before we got off. And then on Gemini 9, when it started, I thought it was probably Gene, you know, that was causing this, but finally realized maybe I was a Joe Blitzblick of the Gemini program. But in fact, I just made a bet with Jim Maloney, that good friendly bet of $1 that we get off on time.
We got a lot of things to worry about, but I don't reckon that's one of them.
In fact, we've got our whole lunar orbit operation keyed to that liftoff time at the Cape. Yes, we can do it if we don't lift off on time or scrub, but it's going to make it lots rougher.
Shorty Pass.
Tom Stafford, would you talk a little bit about your concern or lack of concern over what we might call lunar orbit perturbations? Have you got a good program set, better than we did on 9? Do we know more about lunar orbit perturbations?
At this time, Shorty, we think we do. Actually, what was determined from Apollo 8 and the way that the data correlated, the landmark was sinking in the lunar surface at about 8/10 of a kilometer per rev. And you have to target ahead, so you can see you might be in a little bit of problem. And we had a model called a triaxial lunar model. We've now gone to a model you'll hear called the R2 model. And this is why it's been a real crash program to get it in both our spacecraft and in mission control. And with this, we think we've actually got all the harmonics of the moon in it and everything. However, again, this is a reason for flying this mission and going down right to the point that where the landing mission will start to descend and also the insertion on rendezvous around. We think that we have a handle on it. But again, this is one of the major reasons for flying the mission. We do have enough fuel for contingencies in case it gets to us. But you can see actually what happened on that last one. The perigee kept getting lower and the apogee kept getting higher in the way it was torqued around. But being there 61 hours in lunar orbit, we should have a good handle on that. There's one other point that I think should be brought out. Always around the Earth before in these rendezvous, the ground has had a beautiful solution could help you. And now Chris and the whole people at MCC acknowledges that once we complete the insertion burn, we're on our own because they can't do too much for us. So this is the first time that really the two vehicles are on their own. Now they can give us a ballpark number, but that's all it'll be. And so, however, we think that we have onboard charts and our two onboard computer programs, and they've worked out real good.
Shorty, this is why we look at taking the LEM to the lunar environment. It's not a systems type of test flight for the LEM. By the nature of it, by the fact that we're going close to 400 miles away, by the nature of our perigee, our closeness to the lunar surface, and by the nature of the fact that mission control, after a point, really cannot help you in a rendezvous, we look at this as procedurally an operational flight of the LEM CSM system around the moon. And we feel very strong about that. We're not turning systems on to see if they work. We plan on them working. We're turning them on to use them.
We consider this flight as kind of the final test of the whole system before the landing. Right.
Okay, could I do one quick one? Tom, you said that you or one of your colleagues up there said something about the television that you wanted to share with us. Is that the only purpose of the television?
Actually, I feel that the television would be, we have it all set up to record transposition and docking from an engineering standpoint. But if you can get it in real time, accurately, the way things actually look, that's as valid an engineering requirement as anything that we've got. And the same is true of, for example, undocking, the lunar module inspection. If we get the kind of fidelity out of this piece of equipment that we expect to, I think it'd be a pretty valuable engineering tool.
Shorty, there's other things that we're sending down real time on this mission, that being one of them, that we felt and we talked about had to be sent down, other type of data so that people on the ground could start evaluating it right away, because we're talking about 2 months after we lift off, we're talking about a lunar landing flight. And these guys don't have 2 months, is not very long. And it was really Tom's idea, and he got some people together and said, hey, if we send some of this data down and live television of a lot of these particular parts of the mission are part of that, if we send some of this data down real time, you can start evaluating it right now. And this is going to save 2 weeks, and 2 weeks in our business is a premium. It really is.
A good example, Shorty, if we have one of the lunar module legs hang up, the only way that only one can see this is John with his eyes, or with a camera that he can shoot some pictures. And if the camera malfunctions or anything, this is a backup. And you can look at it real time and start making an engineering evaluation right there in real time.
Might he be able to suggest a procedure whereby we could get it fixed if for a lunar landing, for instance?
Colonel Stafford, it's been said that you're so enthusiastic about this color TV that you might turn it on in other than the scheduled transmissions. Would this be with any kind of warning to us, or just whenever you decided to turn it on?
No. What we think it's going to be a great attribute to the program with respect to just instead of, you know, coming back on a press conference afterwards and telling you what it was like and showing you a few films, that for mission control on the ground, we've worked out a situation where it is somewhat a non-crew experience basis. And particularly, our simulators have come through in great shape, and it's really fantastic, even for the three of us that have flown before, to see the way that the Earth goes away from you right away and the way that the moon goes and goes away from you. And so we have it worked out with Glenn Lunny and Chris Kraft, This is all going to be on tape in Mission Control, and it doesn't interfere with any other data except the tape dump, and actually the tape dump would have priority over it, but we're just going to turn it on. We also have an onboard monitor so we can tell exactly what picture we're sending down. So I expect you can see a few hours of it.
I'd like to ask a more general question. Is it because of some technical insurmountable problem that causes so many of the critical firings in all the Apollo, rather these two Apollo missions around the moon so far, to be carried out on the other side of the moon, out of contact with the Earth?
Just strictly the geometry of the Earth-Moon relationship and where you have to make the maneuver to arrive at the landing point. It's what just like retrofire to land in the Atlantic. And you fire
it's an insurmountable problem, all right.
That's right.
Got to talk to that guy Kepler.
What I had meant was it's not a question of simply slowing down the rate of descent or ascent in order to complete a full orbit to return to the point at which your firing occurred to make that the point of the landing or the low point in the mission.
I guess you could make a big radial maneuver and combine a radial maneuver with a retrograde maneuver, but it would cost you fuel, and this way it works out awful. I guess you could come around another way, but
sure,
it'd be awful.
But you could do all these things on the front side of the moon, but not on the kind of fuel we've got or the kind of engine we have. You just couldn't do it, or the way orbital mechanics are.
See, and we are simulating.
Had enough power, you could do anything.
Simulating the descent burn of the LEM when it separates from the command module, and of course, fuel being a critical thing, you make the most conservative in terms of fuel, fuel-wise type of burn you can.
I would like for each of you to describe your emotions, your real feelings about anxiety. Are you really human and it's kind of scary? Are you so trained that you have nerves of steel? And do you think at this time you might take tranquilizers or any kind of medication on your trip?
Well, Lee, I'll tell you, after all the meetings and training, it's going to be nice to get out of town and get away from this place. It'll be a real relaxing thing, I'll tell you. John?
I agree with everything Tom said. We've been looking forward to this for 3 years.
I couldn't agree with John more. No, we went through this EVA exercise this morning in suits, and this is, you know, when you get down to some of the type of training we do, it's not the most grand and glorious days in the world, and we just all made a comment, you know, let's fly, because we feel we're ready to fly and we're anxious to fly, and that's really all there is to it.
Shorty Powers.
First of all, I got a little bit confused. Somebody called you Colonel. Isn't it Captain Stafford?
Come on, Shorty.
Are you carrying on this mission, are you carrying any Defense Department experiments? Do those experiments include infrared photography?
No.
None at all?
We have just standard, what you'd call GI black and white and color film, ASA 64.
You are not carrying any DOD experiments?
No, sir, not that I know of.
Around the moon?
That's right.
Any further questions? Well, at this point, we'll close it.
Thank you, John.
So you don't have more fun than humans, huh?